The semi-annual warehouse clearance event is on at Sleep Outfitters. Save up to $1,000 store-wide with our lifetime price guarantee and 100% comfort guarantee. Why shop anywhere else? Limited time clearance savings only at Sleep Outfitters. Visit sleepoutfitters.com.
Welcome to the Jazz Shapers podcast from Mishkon Dorea. What you're about to hear was originally broadcast on Jazz FM. However, the music has been cut due to rights issues.
This is Jazz Shapers with Elliot Moss on Jazz FM. In partnership with Mishkon Dorea. It's business, but it's personal. Listening colour.
Welcome to Jazz Shapers with me, Elliot Moss, bringing the shapers of the business world together with the musicians shaping jazz, soul and blues. My guest today is Maya Mufarek, founding CMO of Pharmacy 2, the NHS-approved online pharmacy, and founder of her own growth consultancy called Marketing Cube. Multicultural and multilingual, with her father French-Lebanese and her mother Russian, Maya refers to her time working with fast-growing companies, Cisco, Google, and Not on the High Street, and with American Express, as a learning playground. That's nice, isn't it? Managing partnerships, marketing, and product development. And as the founding CMO of Pharmacy 2, Maya digitized the UK healthcare industry, bringing repeat prescription management online, very important to me and many others I know. Under her leadership, they delivered a 15% saving to the NHS in medication costs and became the largest online pharmacy with over 500,000 subscribers. And in 2019, she did it. She founded her own thing called Marketing Cube, a growth consultancy for innovative startups, we hope they're innovative, and scale-ups. And Maya has since guided hundreds of tech founders to build their brand towards profitable, scalable growth. Sounds good. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. 2019 was when you set this business up. I'm amazed you waited that long to do your own thing completely. Why?
I mean, Pharmacy 2 was my own thing, I think. We didn't start from scratch, but it definitely felt like my thing. My partner. Yeah, absolutely. With my partners, Mark and Gary, it was just it was my very first baby. Is the way I feel about this. And so it's really great to see it go out in the world and be the third largest pharmacy in this country and doing so well and doing so much good in the tech, health tech kind of world in the UK. But 2019, I had my daughter. I wanted to kind of start doing other things. And really, I wish I had a grand plan that was, I will start my own thing and it will be a growth consultancy. It didn't really pan out this way. It was very much went back, you know, speaking to founders, seeing what's going on, figuring out what my next move might be, what other business I might be working with, starting. And I was faced by the stark realization and like firsthand experience of why CMOs are the, you know, the shortest tenure and the C-suite.
Chief marketing officers.
Which is a year plus or something is the average tenure of chief marketing officers in businesses. It's because founders don't really properly value it, understand it, but also if they don't understand the growth paths in front of them, they're not hiring the right CMOs. And so if you're a mismatch, it's just never going to work. And so the more I was having those conversations with founders, the more basically we would agree to the fact that why don't I figure out what that growth path might look like for you, what foundations you need to put in place. Let's do that together, and then I'll help you hire the right CMO. I think my kind of most successful case study from day one was with a business called Ulife. Life insurance company that, as Sammy, the founder, says, we want to celebrate life, not what life insurance is supposed to protect you from. And so I did that bit with them, loved it, helped them hire Lauren, who's leading brilliantly their marketing organization today. And so that just became my first path into that was pre-pandemic. The word fractional was not exactly a word that was heavily used, but that was my first starting point of having a bit of this fractional career, I guess, and building my growth consultancy. And then with my Pharmacy 2 exit, I was very keen to put back into the ecosystem in the UK. And so I started angel investing, knew nothing about that, learned about that. And then eventually board roles and other roles came through. And so I have a portfolio career, as they call it apparently now. So that's my mix.
Lots of stuff going on. Let's just talk. I mentioned the accent. Where were you born?
I was born in Russia in the 80s. My Lebanese dad was running a French business under the umbrella of the French embassy, obviously, since that was communist Russia back then. And I went to the French embassy school there. I was kind of I was a bilingual kid. Russian-French was my beginning. And then with the perestroika, my dad started feeling not completely safe for us.
This is late 80s now, 88, 89,
yeah, 90s, early 90s, yeah. And so he asked to be to move to France with the business he was running that had a headquarters in France.
And you were how old at that point?
Sort of I was 10. It was kind of first cultural shock. It's weird to say, but to some extent, you know, you're going to French school, you're fully fluent, you have been hanging out with French kids. But it's a very different light to be an expat versus being kind of back into, I think, even just the national educational system in the country, to be honest. And also, I remember vividly my first day. It was also my first day in high school. And they were like, where are you from? Like, what school were you in? And I was like, I was in Moscow. And I was like, where's that? Like, that was a bit, because they were expecting like a school name from the neighborhood. But yeah, so it was not the easiest transition, but definitely one that kind of was formative in resilience.
I studied Russian politics as part of my degree, which I've always been fascinated with it, and perestroika and glasnost, will be restructuring and openness and all those other things. As a 10-year-old, were you aware that these were, quote-unquote, good things to be happening in Russia? And I know that's a lot to ask of you now, but was there a sense of, whilst it may have changed for your family, there were things happening which were beneficial? Because I think about you and your career, and you're often looking at good stuff. You're often looking at, you know, you seem to be someone who sees the bigger patterns. I wonder if even if looking back, you can go, hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you know, as a 10-year-old, what I remember is, you know, neighbors getting stuff ready to go support people who are basically pushing the White House in Russia, and so very much supportive of that change. But similarly, you know, I also could see within my Russian family and just generally what's happening in the streets for people that life wasn't particularly easy. And so I think it's just this balancing of, you know, change which comes with hardship at the end of the day. And I think absolutely, I think there was an understanding that things needed to change. And I could see the stark contrast from our travels and other countries versus what was happening in Russia. And, you know, a few years later, when my cousins who are 10 years younger than me, you know, would land jobs with PwC and, you know, really make a great living and travel. Like, for me, that was just the closest to home of how different their life is now than what it would have been if that change hadn't happened. So, you know, absolutely. I think it wasn't particularly, you know, there was massive debates in the household that I participated in, but that's my memories from that time.
And being an immigrant, having that movement around the world and being kind of always feeling like a little bit of an outsider maybe, has that been good for you? Is that one of your if you were a brand, Maya, and I will come on to ask you to define what your brand stands for, where does the outsider immigrant bit fit into your brand model?
You know, really, I think my multicultural background had taught me that really your difference is your superpower. And once I managed to embrace that, I think everything becomes much easier. Yes, I'm different. You know, take it or leave it kind of thing.
I love that.
Honestly, because like at some point, like I'm not going to spend my life convincing people of the value of that. And so, and I know the value that it gives me. I think it's just and even beyond what I was, you know, luckily provided with by life and where I was born, I always sought additional exposure. I wanted to see more things. I wanted to be exposed to more topics. And I think realistically, that's why I so enjoy what I'm doing today, because no day is the same and constantly different. And there's no, you know, monotony. And you always need to kind of think of on your feet. So I do think that that's kind of what really contributed a lot to the rest of my experience. And people are like, oh, it's great. You speak so many languages. But it's not really about the languages. It's about your ability to understand many different perspectives. You can agree with them or not, but at least have some kind of empathy to why those people might feel this way or believe such things. And that I think is invaluable. And, you know, without going too philosophic about this, I think peace in the world will only come once we start connecting better. So,
vote for Maya Mufarek. She is my business shaper today, and you're right. Much more coming up from her in a couple of minutes. Right now, we're going to hear a taster from the Mishcon Innovation Series, which you can find on all the major podcast platforms. Lydia Kellett invites business founders to share their industry insights and practical advice for those of you thinking about getting into an industry and starting your very own thing. You know, I think that's a great idea. In this clip, we hear from Tarek Rauf, architect and founder and CEO, it's a lot of titles, isn't it, of Catalogue, a digital work hub aiming to give people a radically simpler way to coordinate work.
The Mishcon Innovation Series. Inspiration from founders of cutting-edge businesses. In association with Jazz Shapers, with Mishcon Dereya.
I think founding your own business has a lot to do with understanding what you're looking to do in founding a business. Like, why do you do it? Betting on yourself and acquiring all the skills necessary to build a team, build a product, market it, raise the capital. It can be quite a lot of friction, but it can also be quite a lot of fun. And if you know why you're doing it, it gets a lot easier. I've always been interested in making and building things, which is where I got into architecture, which is where I've been making software. And so a large parts of my job don't feel like a job. The parts that, you know, running a company is still, there's a million friction points every day. There's friction with customers, there's friction with product, there's friction with all kinds of, you know, unforeseen issues that pop up every now and then. But when you find joy in the act of building, which is what I do, it just becomes a necessary pain on the side effect. And so knowing why you're building a company, why you want to start a business and what you're looking to get out of it and having clarity around that generally helps quite a bit.
The Mishcon Innovation Series. In association with Jazz Shapers, with Mishcon Dereya.
Jazz Shapers on Jazz FM. In partnership with Mishcon Dereya. It's business, but it's personal.
You can enjoy all our former Business Shapers on the Jazz Shapers podcast, and you can hear this very program again if you pop Jazz Shapers into your favorite podcast platform. My guest today is Maya Mufarrik. It's a great sounding name, by the way. I sound like Donald Trump. Great sounding name. Founding CMO of Pharmacy 2. I really don't sound like him. The NHS approved online pharmacy and founder of the growth consultancy Marketing Cube. He is an incredible marketeer, whether you like him or not. I mean, the power of communication, the power of persuasion, it's your thing. Mm-hmm. How did it become your thing?
It became my thing because I think I was always really interested in psychology and I never did a degree in psychology. And I then suddenly realized that as I started to study marketing and be very interested in, you know, how you convince people to do something or how do you support a change, I guess, with communication, that it was at the end of the day, it all came back to people psychology. And if you don't understand it, then you can't make that work. And so that's very much, I think, how I realized that was my thing.
Do you think it was also your thing because you were in so many different cultures? Like you talked about perspectives before. Mm. Was it that sense of having to work out the lay of the land because, okay, Maya, you're in a new situation here. What's cooking? Was it that as well?
It was. I think what I tend to say is, you know, to be a good marketer, you have to have empathy. If you don't have empathy, you can't understand your audience. You can't, you know, engage with them. And so, you know, I tend to say in my angel investing, even I invest with empathy to the audience that they're serving or the problem they're trying to solve. I think empathy is where it's coming from. And yes, I think the more you see and the more you try to connect with the world, the more you develop that muscle.
My title is Chief Brand Officer. So, and remarkably, I've been with Mishcon Dereya for 15 and a half years.
Wow,
and I
congrats.
Keep going, we keep reinventing. We keep saying this is what brand is. Mm. How would you define brand? Because I'm not going to give you my definition unless it's just the same as yours.
Well, for me, brand is really what they say when you're not in the room, what your customers say to their friends, their family. It's not what you say your brand is. That's very much what it is. And so often when I speak to people who are not very familiar with brand, I tend to say, like, you have to start small fires and let those fire kind of build up on their own. And they build up by what people say about you. And eventually you kind of end up at Nike level, right? But it's not an infinite amount of marketing or media or anything like that. It's very much building that community. And I think it's, with social media, it has become more of an understanding that it does start with a community and people talking to each other. Because now you have kind of a digital space where that can happen, but it had always worked like that even before social media existed.
So if I'm a founder of a business, and you've worked with many of them, and I've got this incredible widget, and then I say to you, it just kind of works, Maya. I mean, really, what's this rubbish called brand? Just, it's a good product. It sells at the right price. What's the general gist of the conversations you have with people? And I imagine a lot just come and say, but I've done my product market fit. I know it works. Why do I need this thing called brand? What's your response?
So, first of all, the great news is if their product worked, that's already a great starting point, because no amount of marketing will fix a bad product, right? Like, so that's the, you know, first check, foundation in place, product is working. The next one really, you know, build it and they'll come, like a lot of Silicon Valley used to say, is not really a strategy. No amount of extraordinary innovation or quality product is worth anything if no one knows about it, right? And that doesn't mean that you have immediately to go on TV or do billboards. What it really means is how do you facilitate that, you know, being shared? But most importantly, beyond even thinking of who is it for, it's like, at what moment does someone really need that? And so, for example, at Pharmacy to You, you know, it was all about like the frustrations of patients having basically to do their own health concierging, right? Like call, and this is, you know, 2010, right? So you like call your GP, ask for a repeat, then go and wait at the, you know, wait for that appointment, go and get the paper, go to the pharmacy, they don't have what you need, etc. And but the reality, the stark moment where they're sitting at this GP practice waiting for an appointment they don't want just to pick up a piece of paper is really where the frustration is. And they're like, there must be a better way, but they're convinced there's not, right? And so we started basically realizing that GP surgeries do sell media space in there, in these GP surgeries, because they are businesses at the end of the day, and they need to make money with everything they have available. And so that's where we started putting some communication, you know, a billboard with a little leaflet about like, you don't need to be here, sign up here, we'll take care of it.
So in one word, what was the brand for Pharmacy to You?
It was your prescription taken care of. Like that's that was really, because the problem is people were being some kind of health concierge to themselves with no value add whatsoever.
Yeah. And yours, one word?
My personal?
Your personal brand, we're right on the spot.
Interesting.
Here in the hot seat, it's Jazz Shapers on Jazz FM. What's going to happen next?
Well, my personal is very much around empathy, resilience, and innovation.
I think took three there, but you can't.
Oh, sorry, that's okay.
No, that's good. Empathy, yeah. Resilience.
And innovation.
There you go. Stay with me for much more from my empathetic, resilient, and persuasive business shaper. It's Maya Mufarak, and she's the founder of Marketing Cube. And she also, before doing the whole Pharmacy to You thing, which was a reinvention of the category, as it were, you're a Google person. And there are many Google alumnus that come out and do amazing things in the world. Mm. Why is that true?
I mean, I started referring to my Google days as really the best MBA I could have ever had. When I left Google, there was a consideration of doing an MBA because I, you know, I thought that was the right thing to do. It was kind of this, you know, good first experience, do that. And then very quickly realized that Google was my MBA and my network, because I only knew the Googlers who were in because I was so early on. And then very quickly, we all kind of started spreading around and that became my network. I mean, Google is a different place now, obviously. It's a, you know, much bigger engine. I joined, there was maybe 4,000 of us and left when there was 25,000 of
2005,
us.
2005, you joined. That's 2011, right. You left.
Yeah, yeah. And it was just...
It's 20 years ago.
I know.
That's ridiculous. Where did that go?
I know.
But it was the frontier, wasn't it?
It was the frontier. It was... It was very much, you know, there was more work than we had people to do. So you always could, you know, work on what you really were excited about. For me, it was very special because it was a very diverse crowd. And so I, you know, for the first time, it felt like I was actually not the odd one out. It was just one of many odd ones out, which was really great. A lot of international people, a lot of different backgrounds. A very energizing place. So I have the best memories from that time. You know, it was really the frontier of consumer marketing, of
digital. But the energy is what, yes, I'm interested in. That sense of, you know, you work and invest in lots of startups. That's what you do. Mm. How did they create the culture that worked, that drove Google for so many years? And what was it about the culture that was special that you take away and you go, look, I know things are different. I know that was the time then, but here's some things I learned from Google that we absolutely should be doing.
I mean, the default was, you know, default to action. Like, it wasn't about talking about things or planning for things. It was just getting it done. And getting it done well, obviously, but there was a constant default to action. You were as good as your last project, your last delivery. And so everything was moving fast, and everyone was going in the same direction, though. There was clarity on, I call them must-win battles now, like corporate must-win battles. What are we working on? What are we focused on? You know, from corporate all the way down. And most of us, especially in that time, maybe it's different now, could really refer to the work you're doing right now. How does it refer to the overall company objective for this year? Mm. And so some of my projects included, you know, international expansion in EMEA. And so that was
Europe, Middle East, and Africa.
Yeah.
These lovely acronyms that come from your work. No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, unfortunately, I've been indoctrinated as well.
Yeah.
Many years of working with Procter & Gamble, wonderful company, yeah. And all those other places.
That's
all
right.
Wonderful. Three-letter acronyms. You need them all.
Yeah. And so you know, expanding in Europe and you know, you could see how that was the next frontier for Google as well. Like, they had only really covered Europe up to Germany or so, right? And things like that. Then, you know, with the advent of protecting their search empire, Chrome, and better
but
web
action.
Browsers.
What I'm hearing is action. And just as a thought, I look at the work you do, incredibly structured. You have to be programmatic. Mm. And on the other side of the balance sheet for you, Maya, is this empathy.
Mm.
So on the one hand, you need all this, you give people structure and you are structured. On the other hand, you're empathetic and you're listening. How do you square the two? Because sometimes they can be in conflict.
Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, I partner with a lot of wonderful product visionary founders. And what's interesting is there's so much in the detail and so much in the passion of what they're trying to change, but they often can't actually articulate it with passion and empathy. They're very much like, you know, how this innovation is going to change the world, but not really in a way that everyone else can relate, in a very kind of technology innovation angle of it. And that's really most of my work is about saying, but do you realize how you're a net positive in the world if you really articulate it at the grander scale of the impact? And that's what we did at Pharmacy to You at the end of the day, is that not only it's a category transforming, you know, proposition and game changer for patients and their ability to manage their health, but it's really a game changer for the health industry in the UK and proven by the numbers, and I did a lot of work to be able to, you know, qualify that impact. So that's really the balance, is that just being able to get all the nitty-gritty from those founders that is formulaic and then really elevate it to something we can all empathize with.
Well, that sounds good. Final chat coming up with my guest there. It's Maya Mufarrig, just in case you hadn't noticed. And we've got some music from Sister Sledge, none other. That's in just a moment. Don't go anywhere.
Jazz Shapers on Jazz FM. In partnership with Mishkondareya. It's business, but it's personal.
I'm Elliot Moss, this is Jazz Shapers, and my business shaper is Maya Mufarrig, just for a few more minutes. You do tons of stuff. When we started talking, I started saying you're this multi-hyphenated person. There's the marketing side, there's the board memberships, there's the investor piece. You invest in a lot of startups. What's the biggest buzz for you? I know you're going to say I love it all, but if I had to focus on one thing, if you were to commit to one area where you go, I love it when... Is that the investment piece when they come through? Is it the, where is it?
No, I'm so much more an operator at heart. It's actually when, you know, you've been grinding with founders to try to find that product market fit, and now suddenly things start just moving.
Okay.
And that's really the magic of innovation and startups. It's when, like, it clicks. Now, it might click for a while and then unclick again, and
yep.
So you constantly need to adapt, and I think that's really important. But it's just so rewarding to see those founders that requires so many personal sacrifices and resilience to get through that bit. And so in any way I can help and contribute to that stage, I love it.
And you mentioned the ecosystem earlier in terms of giving stuff back to it. What is your sense of the health of the UK tech ecosystem right now? Where are we in the cycle? Are we doing okay? Have we got work to do? What's the mark?
I mean, I'm hoping we're coming to the end of the hard cycle. Obviously, you know, high interest rate, etc. Yeah. A lot of, you know, smaller VCs folding. There's not much cash in the market right now. So I think hopefully we're coming to the other end of that.
And women within that? Is it getting better? Because a lot of people, I've had Debbie Wasco on the program a few times and many other brilliant female entrepreneurs, and they often bemoan the state of fundraising opportunities and the like.
I mean, the stark reality is still that only 2% of VC capital is going into women-founded businesses, and that's dramatically bad. I do think that, you know, the at least the awareness is there. We're bringing more, you know, men and other diverse allies around the table to contribute to that difference and to change things. I definitely am very passionate of bringing more women in tech. I mean, I've been the only kind of woman at around the table for many years. But I love this industry, and I think that's really important. I heavily invest in femtech as well and other kind of places where men just can't have this empathy to understand the problem. So there's still a very long road, but I think the more we, you know, it just like with brands, it needs to start with small fires, right? You get a Whitney and Bumble who exits. You get, you know, a Debbie Wasco and many others, right? That just, you just need to have that reference in front of you. And I know I was very lucky at Google because we had a bunch of VP of marketing ladies and others. And so I could like see what future me could be like if I wanted those jobs because I could see them having it. And so I think, so for me, it's still a long road, but you know, we just need more representation. And we kind of, the one thing that really gets on my nerves is like, we need to empower women. Like, women don't need empowerment. We are self-empowered. Thank you very much. You know, we just need, you know, access and capital. Like, that's what we really need. And so that's what I'm trying to facilitate as well I can through introductions, through just even, you know, talking to the younger generations about, you know, some things to look at. And I'm like, I was so damn lucky because I was oblivious to that status of woman in tech. I was just like, I'm different anyway. Like my difference was in so many other than just my gender that I was oblivious to the gender difference and underrepresentation in tech. And so most probably affected me without me knowing it, but I just, you know, I just powered through and never paid any attention to it. And now I realize how much harder it is for many people. So really keen to change that.
Keep powering through. It's been great talking to you, Maya. Thank you for your time. Just before I let you sail off and fix problems and define brands and all the rest of it, let me know what your song choice is and why you've chosen it.
Yeah, my song choice is Beirut by Ibrahim Malouf. Unbeknownst to me, he is the nephew of Amin Malouf, whose book, The Identity That Kills, I think, is the translation in
English.
In the
Name of Identity?
In the Name of Identity.
Yeah, which I have down here as your favorite book.
Yes, absolutely. Good research.
Very good research. it takes a team to deliver the stupidity that I come out with, yes.
Yeah, and his book very, you know, talks about multiculturalism and the value of that exposure, which in my 20s, I think, what allowed me to embrace that,
well, it's
that
you,
diversity,
isn't it?
Exactly.
It is you.
And so Ibrahim Malouf, who's a Lebanese-French musician, recorded this very melancholic song about Beirut in the 90s when he first, as a teenager, got to roam around the city and was a bit, you know, I guess sad about the state of it. And, you know, I spent, luckily, in peaceful Beirut a lot of summers in my teens, and I love it dearly. And so that was my choice.
Ibrahim Malouf with the thoughtful Beirut, the song choice of my business shaper today, Maya Mufarrik. She said, your difference is your superpower. And I know we've heard that before, but just remember how important it is. It really is the thing that makes you stand out. I always sought out additional exposure, she said. That sense of being open to perspectives, to being open to cultures. It's where the good stuff happens. And finally, and really importantly, you have to have empathy. If you're going to create a strong business and a strong brand, you have to always put yourselves in the shoes of your customers. That's it from Jazz Shapers. Have a lovely weekend.
Jazz Shapers on Jazz FM. In partnership with Mishkondareya. It's business, but it's personal.
We hope you enjoy that edition of Jazz Shapers. You'll find hundreds more guests available for you to listen to in our archive. To find out more, just search Jazz Shapers in iTunes or your favourite podcast platform, or head over to mishkon.com/jazzshapers.
The semi-annual warehouse clearance event is happening now at Sleep Outfitters. This is your chance to save big with up to 65% off mattresses store-wide. Plus, get a free adjustable base with select Sealy mattresses. These limited-time warehouse clearance deals won't last, and with our lifetime price guarantee, you can rest assured you're getting the best deal. The semi-annual warehouse clearance event, only at Sleep Outfitters. Visit sleepoutfitters.com to find a store near you.